This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this program, Vice Chair of the JLM, Ruth Smith, talks about the Labour Party's virtual conference and how life as a member has changed for her since the departure of Jeremy Corbyn. We hear about the fascinating story of Dr. Denise Taylor, who forgave her brother's killer. Yes, I know, it really is as shocking as that sounds. Forgave her brother's killer and even befriended him. This is being used as an inspirational lesson to his community by Rabbi Yoni Golka in the run-up to Yom Kippur. We look forward to hearing about that later. And as if all of that isn't enough, we'll also hear from comedian Ashley Blaker as he's back with his take on the world as we've come to know it. But before all of that, let's have a look at your copy of the Jewish News for this week. And joining me to go through it is news editor Justin Cohen and features editor Fran Wolfish. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Phil.
Hi, Phil.
Right, let's have a look first and foremost at the front page in traditional fashion. And we have two stories on the front page that we're going to look at today. First one being more than half of British Jews fear return to shul, Justin.
Yeah, this is the findings of a new survey from the Institute for Jewish Policy Research. They spoke to around 7,000 British Jews in July, so notably at a time when cases were actually falling still of coronavirus. And it indicated that people edged on the side of being very uncomfortable at the prospect of returning to full communal life, whether that be in synagogues, other events in communal buildings and so on. 46% said that they were between 7 and 10 concerned or uncomfortable about returning to shul when 10 is the most uncomfortable. And just a quarter said that they were very comfortable. So really, the authors of this report are saying that this is really a wake-up call, that organisations and communal leaders really need to start moving and thinking about how to engage people, and particularly people of different age groups. You know, the elderly in particular, who perhaps are less inclined to come into communal buildings.
Well, I was going to say, Fran, I wonder how much that's got to do with it, actually, whether or not if you look at, say, how typically shulgoers tend to be older, and as a result of it, I think the older members of community and society, full stop, have had the fear of God put into them with this whole coronavirus thing. And I wonder if that's probably got something to do with it as well.
Well, it's an interesting point, because the survey actually showed that in the 85 plus bracket, they were actually the least worried about returning to shul. But I think that might be down to the fact that they see themselves as going to shul for a shul service, so, you know, once a week. Whereas the group that was showing the sort of real anxiety are in the younger end of the spectrum, the sort of 16 to 24 year olds. They're the ones who would go to social events, parties, you know, sort of the bigger mass scale gatherings. And they have more anxiety about returning to communal events. So there is some sort of logic to this survey, but I think what it does show is that shuls do need to engage more. As Justin said, they need to break it down into different age groups and cater for those different age groups, whether that's through virtual events or smaller gatherings. Obviously, at the moment, we're restricted down to 6 people. So yes, it's concerning times, definitely, for communal organisations.
And also on the front page this week, the death and tribute paid to a bit of a legend of American justice.
Yeah, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the legendary Supreme Court judge in the US, died just at the beginning of Rosh Hashanah at the age of 87, following an illness. She, really, the tributes that have come in, and the breadth from people that have actually paid tribute, from politics, from the media, from celebrities, Gal Gadot and Natalie Portman, for example. You know, you can't imagine another lawyer in the world, I imagine, that would have that kind of outpouring of grief and of tributes at their death. Certainly, I can't think of anyone in this country that would receive that.
And I can't think of anyone, correct me if I'm wrong, who's a legal eagle who would be lying in state like she is at the moment.
Absolutely. She's the first Jew and the first woman to lie in state in the Capitol in Washington. So, yeah, that's really a mark of of the impact she had. You know, we've written in this week's Leader column that she was just 5 foot tall, but was an absolute giant of her industry.
Extraordinary individual, Fran, of course, someone who inspired many people in their career and their political stances. Funnily enough, on both sides of the fence, this is what's quite interesting, is I'm not sure I actually know many people in that position who would inspire both sides of the political spectrum, from the Republicans to the Democrats.
She stood for so much. She kind of superseded the law, didn't she? It was so much more than that. She fought for humans. She fought for equality. She inspired the generation and the generation after her to be what they wanted to be, to stand up for themselves, to have equality, whether they were a woman, whether they, you know, they're gay, whether, you know, whatever their sort of orientation, she believed in equality. And that's why she will be remembered so fondly. One of my favorite anecdotes about her, someone once said to her, "When will there be enough women in the Supreme Court?" And she answered, "When there are nine." Well, of course, there's only nine judges altogether, but it's just such a brilliant answer, because in her mind, you know, men had it good for so many hundreds of years. Why shouldn't women have, you know, an all-woman Supreme Court? Well, wouldn't that be amazing?
Well, I tell you, from one fighter to the next, Fran, on page 29 this week, you have been speaking to Natan Sharansky about his new book.
Yes, Natan Sharansky, of course, was a prominent refusenik. He grew up under the communist regime of the Soviet Union. And what's interesting is he has brought out a book called Never Alone, Prison Politics and My People. It's not a memoir. It's kind of a reflection back at his 9 years that he spent in prison, his 9 years spent in Israeli politics, shaping the nation that he had adopted as his new country and his home. And he then spent, of course, 9 years as the head of the Jewish Agency, promoting Israel to the diaspora and the diaspora to Israel. What's really nice about the 999, and I'm not spelling out an emergency here, is Natan Sharansky, of course, loves numbers. He's a mathematician. And there's just this beautiful symmetry in his life to having three strands of his life split up in those ways. But I was fortunate enough to speak to him and about his time, his 9 years in prison, the hunger strikes that he went on, the forced feeding that he endured, the terrible conditions he went through, all in the name of trying to promote, you know, freedom, liberty, Jewish identity, helping other Russian Jews who wanted to get out of Russia and go to Israel.
One can only begin to imagine the stories he's got to tell. That's Natan Sharansky's new book, Never Alone, Prison Politics and My People. Just finally, obviously, this weekend just gone saw Rosh Hashanah, and this weekend to come sees Yom Kippur, but shuls have been getting quite innovative about how they deliver services to folk, haven't they?
I think we've seen throughout the pandemic, from the very first days, that the community has adapted in very impressive and quick ways to reaching the community through Zoom, through other online events and so on. But as we kind of move slightly away from at home only reality into a kind of a middle road where people can gather in careful COVID friendly ways, the Finchley Reform Synagogue organised a very impressive initiative at the weekend where they brought together a number of congregants in cars at a drive-in service, Saracens Rugby Ground in Hendon. And by all accounts, from hearing from a couple of the people who were actually there, it was extremely successful and really garnered a feeling of community spirit in a way that you simply can't do through Zoom only. So that was, I thought, a fantastic innovation and perhaps one of the highlights of COVID-friendly community that we've seen.
Certainly is. And also just a couple of others to mention as well. Sam's, which is, of course, is the St. Albans Masorti Synagogue. They were working with St. Albans Cathedral so that they could blow the shofar from the cathedral so that people around them could hear it. That's extraordinary. And then my very own EHRS, Edgerow and Hendon Reform Synagogue, I know that they were broadcasting live, not one, not two, but three services. It was a multi-channel online service that you could actually pick and choose which service you wanted to watch. And the reason why I know that is I was part of the tech team who was delivering it. And let me tell you, the weirdest Rosh Hashanah service I've ever been a part of, because I've never, ever before produced a Rosh Hashanah service like that. I'm just saying, it was very weird, but very successful.
One more plug while we're at it. the chief rabbi will be leading a Yizkor service ahead of Yom Kippur on Sunday. And it's really, I think a lot of people will be tuning in for that. I imagine they'll go into the thousands.
I would imagine that will probably be broadcast on US TV, which is the United Synagogues television channel. So there you go. Marvellous stuff. Thank you both very much indeed. Wishing you well over the fast if you indeed do that. That is news editor Justin Cohen, features editor Fran Wolfish. Don't forget that if you want to collect your copy of the Jewish News, you can every Thursday, or you can read the full paper online as it would be printed if you are isolating. That's at jewishnews.co.uk. Thank you both very much indeed.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you. Thanks, Phil.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. First up this week, it seems a bit odd for me to say that it's conference season, because obviously, well, conference season is like everything else this year, not what it should be. However, it does mean that the mainstream parties are either getting ready or are in the process of discussing their politics, and this week it is the Labour Party's turn. Speaking to me now, I'm delighted to say, is someone who has been at the heart of the Labour Party for long enough to have felt the trials and tribulations I think we all have as a community, and that is the Vice Chair of the JLM, the Jewish Labour Movement, Ruth Smith. I'm very pleased to say joins me on the Jewish News Podcast now. Ruth, first and foremost, thank you for taking time out of what I imagine is a very busy schedule to speak to me. It's much appreciated. And I suppose we need to maybe start off by, dare I suggest, breathing a little bit of a sigh of relief, because I suspect the last time we would have properly heard from you, it might have been a very different situation. Of course, now we have Sir Keir Starmer at the helm, and he seems to be, well, making the right noises, I think is the best way of putting it. Would that be a fair assumption?
Oh, I think the word you've just come to is relief. Just overwhelming, genuine relief about how quick, and also how quickly things have changed. It's only been 6 months since he became leader, and it's so much easier to be Jewish in the Labour Party than it was the other side of April. So, yes, he is not only making the right noises, I think he's doing the right things. Obviously, there is still such a long way to go from the hurt and pain that too many people experienced over the last 5 years. And we've got the EHRC report still to come, and we've still got, you know, ongoing inquiries and legal actions. This is not going to go away overnight. But, I hope that we're really talking about a horrible chapter in the Labour Party in the history books, as opposed to what happens going forward.
Now, speaking of what happens going forwards, because I don't want to dwell too much on the past, I think we are all frankly sick of talking and highlighting anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. So let's look forward. Obviously, this week, as I say, is it's sort of Labour's turn for conference season. Like I said, it just feels very odd to call it a conference because, well, it's not really. But Sir Keir has been speaking, and it would appear as though he has been endorsing your stance on anti-Semitism. He's most definitely not taking any nonsense.
Oh, I think it's quite clear. So on Tuesday, Keir did his speech to our virtual conference. I had the privilege of introducing him, which is in itself a statement of intent from the leadership of the Labour Party, that the page has moved on and that the Labour Party is not what it was, that it squarely is under new management with new leadership. And you can see that by my Twitter feed and my timeline over the last 48 hours. I think there's lots of people who are quite upset, and they're probably the right people to be upset, in my opinion, that I was there. So, yes, the world is moving on. So not only was I there, Keir also once again said that he will rip out anti-Semitism by its roots from the Labour Party. And we are seeing action. I mean, from my own experience, I'd stopped reporting people for anti-Semitic behaviour because there was absolutely no point. And yet, a couple of weeks ago, I rang someone in the Labour Party to say someone had written something about me, and they were quite close to where I live, and my mother had seen it. And just like all good Jewish children, obviously my mother had rung me to say, ah. So I rang to say, look, I don't usually do this, but can we deal with this case? And they'd already suspended them when I called. So I called at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They've been suspended at 9 o'clock that morning. I mean, things are moving in a different way. The Labour Party is acting in a way that they could. I think for all of us, it just shows what could have happened over the last 5 years as opposed to what did happen.
But we do have to be very clear about something, though, is that if you want to try and win back the support of the Jewish community. I'm not saying that it completely abandoned the Labour Party. We're well aware that there are some people who are diehard supporters on both sides of the political fence, and they'll stand by no matter what. But there was a seismic shift, I think, was the general feeling. And it is going to take a long time before the Labour Party probably wins back the trust of the Jewish community.
This wasn't just a couple of people who said vile things about the Jewish community. We had Luciana Berger hounded out of the Labour Party while she was pregnant. And we had what I can only describe as neo-Nazi propaganda handed out at a meeting of Louise Ellman's constituency Labour Party. We had physical violent threats faced by Jewish female parliamentarians. We had too many examples of horror faced by our members. Of course, this is going to take a long time to heal. Of course, our pain and trauma is going to take a long time to come through. But as we all get ready for the fast on Sunday night, there is a period of forgiveness and repentance that we all need to go through. The Labour Party is starting to repent, I hope. And for us, there is a level of forgiveness that we're going to have to grant. As long as Keir remains true to his word, which I am 110% convinced that he will.
Now, as you mentioned already, EHRC report, hopefully imminent, in the coming days, weeks, months, however long it is, let's be honest, nothing's going to stick to time anymore because of thanks to COVID, but whenever it may be. Look, I know that you can't necessarily do more than speak from personal experience, but can you give us a sense of the then versus now? Because obviously, as someone so involved in the Labour Party, such as yourself, do you still, as it were, live in fear of going to work versus now? Do you see what I mean? Can you just try and give us a bit of an insight as to then and now, what it was like for you and what it is like for you?
Okay, so the top lines of what it was like for me, which, I mean, were exceptional and I had to treat them as normal at the time, but I didn't go on public transport. I couldn't be by myself at all. I had to move home because of the level of threat. I mean, every part of my life was touched by it. It would be naive to say that we've completely come through that period, that I am no longer vulnerable. I still have a police panic button and will do for the foreseeable. But, and it's a big but, I can go for a walk by myself, which for 3 years I wasn't able to do. I can go shopping and not feel vulnerable. I mean, I still have my panic button with me, but my life has changed beyond all recognition in a way that shows how restricted it was before. And that's a positive thing. And there's also, I think, one of the things that has given lots of people confidence since Keir became leader. I also know I don't have to put up with any of the nonsense. I mean, I think everyone knows I didn't exactly put up with it beforehand, but everyone else is empowered to slap it down too, or they feel they are. So one of the things that is much lovelier now than it was this time last year even, is that I feel like I've got many more allies. I don't have to engage directly in the fight because other people are doing it for me.
Now, you know, I know the answer to this because I've heard you speak about it before, but I think there will be some people listening who will say, how is it possible that despite all of this, you remained loyal to the Labour Party and that you weren't prepared to jump ship? Just remind people why that was, because there will be quite a few people, I suspect, who are quite shocked that you managed to weather the storm.
Because I'm an anti-racist at heart. And that was always been a driving factor of my politics. This was a fight against racism. Before I got elected, I ran Hope Not Hate. So this for me was, there was a fight to be had that was anti-racist. And the battle happened to be inside the Labour Party. And it is much easier, or I thought it was, to have that fight inside the party rather than outside the party. I can understand why people left. I don't blame them at all. Some people's experiences were very different as well. So on the day that Luciana faced the vote of no confidence from her local party, my party unanimously passed a motion of solidarity. So I had different support networks and I had a different type of Labour Party experience at a local level too. And I thought, and honestly, there are some extraordinary young people who are JLM activists and form the bulk of the JLM executive. And I needed to fight to make it better for them. I kept having this vision. My politics remain on the left. My politics will always be of the left. And I just kept having this vision of a 15-year-old me who wanted to join a political party and what party would they have joined? Because I would never have joined the Conservative Party. I'd have struggled if I saw the Labour Party at that point. So I desperately needed to fix it. And so I stayed to fix it. And the one thing that I think a lot of people would have heard me say is I didn't get elected to be a Jewish MP. I was a Labour politician who happened to be Jewish. And I was quite clear that when Jeremy Corbyn, because of his actions, made me a Jewish MP, he was going to rue the day. He was going to make that the most important part of my identity. Then he did that. I didn't do that. And I was going to fix it. And we will. And, you know, there's still a way to go, but we are fixing it.
Well, might I suggest that the sticking plaster has certainly begun to adhere. So that's certainly a good start. Ruth Smith, Vice Chair of the Jewish Labour Movement, thank you not only for fighting the good fight, but also for speaking to me on the Jewish News podcast. Thank you very much indeed, and well over the fast.
Thank you. Shana Tova. Well over the fast.
This is the Jewish News podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, one of the most extraordinary stories I think I've ever heard for a very, very long time. The next guest that we speak to here on the Jewish News podcast is sort of at the heart of it. Rabbi Yoni Golker has helped to tell the tale, the extraordinary tale, of a woman who has forgiven her brother's killer. Sorry, let that just sink in, okay? Because, I mean, those words are quite powerful in themselves. But that is the situation. Rabbi Golker, of course, of St. John's Wood Synagogue, joins me, I'm delighted to say, on the Jewish News podcast now. And Rabbi Golker, I'm sorry, but this is going to sound really inappropriate of me, but I have to start off with it, and I need you to tell me why, you know, why I think like this, frankly. I, heaven forbid, God forbid, a million times found myself in the same situation as Dr. Denise Taylor, who is the person at the centre of this. I couldn't do it. I mean, she's an extraordinary person, right?
An incredible woman and a very inspirational woman. And frankly, we're not asking anyone to do what she did, and we wouldn't expect anyone to do what she did. But her story was profoundly inspiring. I wanted to share it with everyone. You know, we're coming up to Yom Kippur and the time of the Day of Atonement, the day focused on forgiveness. And I was trying to think of a creative way to really touch people's hearts and get people to stop and think. And I thought this story was so compelling, I had to share it with everyone.
So I think we'd be forgiven for realizing that a lot of people probably don't know who Dr. Denise Taylor is. Would you mind just giving us a little bit of background into her story, sorry, and just say who she is?
Sure, absolutely. So Dr. Denise Taylor's brother, Jonathan, or known as Bo, was murdered in 1984 by a man by the name of Ronnie Fields in a drug deal gone wrong. Terribly tragic story. I actually first came across this story 3 years ago. I was teaching at the time at JFS school. I was preparing a sixth form lesson, and my colleague, Rabbi Hakenbroch of Woodside Park Synagogue, showed me this unbelievable story. And I couldn't believe it. You know, you read the pages, the title of the story, My Brother's Killer Is Now My Friend. As you say, it takes time to sink in. So he was murdered in 1984, and Ronnie was convicted of the murder, and he was sent to prison. He was away for 32 years. And the crazy part of the story was that Denise, who actually works in the prison system in the US, she's a doctor, she decided almost 20 years after her brother had died that she wanted to meet this man and she wanted to speak to him. And obviously, having had that experience of meeting convicted murderers and killers and all sorts of criminals, she had a little bit of awareness of what she was in for. And she decided in 2005, I believe, to make contact. And she wrote to him and he wrote back to her. And it began a relationship and a friendship, and it later turned into quite a close friendship because she was actually the next of kin on his prison documentation. She was his next of kin, which is just unbelievable. It was extraordinary, and I thought to myself, Yom Kippur 2020 is different to any other year. We're going to have a lot less people in shul, and we need to tap into it in a way that people can relate to. And I think this is just such a universal human story, and it's really taken a lot of interest from everybody. So I managed, I don't quite know how, to get hold of the two of them via the original BBC journalist who very kindly put me in touch. And we made contact and we set up a Zoom call and we had the interview.
So let's talk a little bit about that because, and first and foremost, it's extraordinary. I mean, talk about Yom Kippur different to any other. I thought it was around Pesach we're supposed to ask, why is this year different to any other? But let's not dwell on that. But as far as the video that you've recorded, because what you've done is you recorded an interview with them, didn't you? And that's how you've got this out to your community and beyond.
Yeah.
So how did that actually sort of go? It must have been a very awkward conversation, wasn't it? I mean, how could you even begin to talk about it? I was actually very nervous for it.
I've done over lockdown 70 interviews with various people from, you know, really well-known people to chief rabbis, lords and regular lay people. This was the first time I was actually nervous. And I was nervous because to talk to a convicted murderer, it's quite frightening. But at the same time, it's a very complex subject. And I thought there was just so much to bring out. And this was actually originally going to be the launch pad for my Yom Kippur explanatory service at St. John's Wood, which is happening next week. And we're actually sold out. People are coming along to find out more details of this story and to explore the Jewish theme of forgiveness. What is the Jewish view of this? How do we relate to it?
Well, let's try and answer that very question. Obviously, I appreciate that this is only a 10-minute interview, so that could be tricky. But how do we go about interpreting and learning whatever lesson you believe we should learn from your experience with Dr. Denise Taylor and the chap who, I can't get over this, the chap who killed her brother?
Look, I think this is obviously an extreme case, but right now, somewhere in the world, there are teenagers slamming doors. There are husbands and wives having quarrels and arguments. There are neighbors, co-workers, employers, school children having meltdowns. And there are relationships that break down. The concept of forgiveness is something so universal and so important and the very essence of all of our lives. We obviously need to try and understand the mechanism of how forgiveness works. Is it always okay to forgive? When do you forgive? How do you forgive? Do you always grant forgiveness when somebody does something wrong to you? And these are very, very big questions, as you say, much broader for a 10-minute discussion right now, and dare I say, for a one-hour explanatory service on Yom Kippur. But to my mind, there were three bullet points, summaries that I took away from the whole experience, and I'll share those with you now briefly, if I may. Number one, by nature, human beings are judgmental. Yom Kippur is known as the Day of Judgment. And it reminds us really that Hashem, the Almighty, is the ultimate judge. And we are never going to be in the shoes of anybody else. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot tells us, do not judge anybody else until you're standing in their shoes. And you're never going to be standing in anybody else's life circumstances and the challenges that they face. And I think lesson number one is to try to look at each situation with fresh eyes, try not to be judgmental of other people, and try to give people the benefit of the doubt. That's really a challenge. And that's definitely a challenge. And I'm not talking here about murder. I'm talking about regular life situations when things go wrong, when, you know, the broigus, you weren't invited to the bar mitzvah and the invitation actually never came. And these type of basic everyday things that happen, they're real things that happen. And it's human nature to not necessarily judge most favorably. But I think that's takeaway number one. Takeaway number two is we're obviously going through the days of repentance now, and teshuvah is a big topic. It requires self-examination. And really the Mishnah describes how one has to go and ask their fellow man for forgiveness. When you do something wrong to somebody else, you need to go and ask them for forgiveness. It's not always possible. If you've murdered somebody, you can no longer go and ask them for forgiveness. And even Yom Kippur cannot atone those sins. That's something that the Almighty will deal with. A complex aspect of this discussion, but something that we'll be talking about more on Yom Kippur. And finally, point three is that we believe in ultimate justice. And this is a paramount principle in Judaism and Jewish philosophy, that really the world is run by the Almighty and God is forgiving. You know, the whole book of Jonah, which we'll read on the afternoon of Yom Kippur, it's about second chances. And this is not just for Jewish people, this is for universally, for every human being in this world. God wants forgiveness and God wants us to try and get on well.
That's what we take away from it. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much indeed. Just before we let you go, I think that it is quite important for us to establish. Now, it wasn't any hidden secret towards the start of this year when the coronavirus outbreak first occurred that unfortunately you weren't very well with coronavirus. I'm delighted to see you here and delighted to talk to you. How are you now?
Thank God, I'm very well. You know, it's been a very unusual year. We were very blessed to have a baby during the lockdown. We had a baby the same day as Boris. We had a pandemic baby born on the same day as Wilfred Johnson. It's been a very unusual year. And I think a lot of people around the world are going into these high holy days really with a new understanding of the book of life and book of death are open in front of us. You know, there are a lot of people suffering, a lot of people financially struggling, and businesses, especially in the entertainment world, really, really struggling right now. So our prayers go out to everybody. But at the same time, there have been silver linings throughout the year. We've seen some real great opportunities of community, people getting together, that, you know, just the clap for NHS, just one example, my kids running out downstairs with the pots and the pans and the clonking, and really that sense of community, which I hope will live on long after all of this. Please, God.
It's a very nice thought to end on. Just absolutely finally, if anyone does want to watch My Brother's Killer Is Now My Friend, where can they find it? I assume it's online.
Sure. So they can find this now on the amazing new US TV. I don't know if anyone's seen this, but the United Synagogue have put out a new TV channel. The US.TV is the web address. And on there is a whole section of programs specifically for the High Holy Days and throughout the year as well. So that's the place to tap in to our new virtual channel. And I wish you well over the fast.
And you as well, Rabbi Yoni Golka, Rabbi at St. John's at Wood Synagogue. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the Jewish News Podcast.
All the best.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Time for a little light relief now, I think. And it comes courtesy of comedian Ashley Blaker.
Hello, Ashley Blaker here, back on the Jewish News Podcast, and I hope you all had a very good New Year and that you were able to maybe get out of the house at some point, pop into synagogue. Maybe you got to hear the shofar blown locally. I know many rabbis were going around their communities blowing the shofar like a very poor man's busker. They don't know a lot of tunes. They only really know three notes. I actually had quite a good Rosh Hashanah, though. Unfortunately, I did spend a few days in hospital after I tried that idea I talked about last week of eating apple dipped in detergent for a virus-free New Year. Wasn't as good an idea as I thought it would be. Although that said, still better than many kosher restaurants I've eaten in. And of course now we've entered the 10 days of repentance between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when we need to seek forgiveness from those we've caused pain. When 2020 is ready to apologise, I'm all ears. And of course, what everyone's talking about this week is new rules, because Boris Johnson has changed the goalposts again. And there are rules regarding restaurants and shops and pubs closing earlier. I presume that rule wouldn't affect any listeners to a Jewish podcast. If that affects you, I think you're listening to the wrong podcast, quite frankly. One of the changes, of course, is that there's now only going to be allowed 15 people at a wedding, but still 30 at a funeral. Marry a corpse, and you can get it up to 45. Also, you just know some clever Jew is going to combine a chuppah and a levaya to try and increase the guests. You just need to make sure you don't go around saying, please God buy you, to the mourners. If anyone's listening who's involved at Bushy Cemetery, please get in touch. Maybe we can go halves on this idea. I think it's a winner. I mean, I wouldn't be too happy if somebody tried to cut my wedding suit with a knife, but I think it's a very good idea. You could even combine the shiva and the shaver brachas. If you get a good food rota going for the shiva, you even save money on catering. The more I think about it, I think that clever Jew might just be me. But people are saying at the moment, I keep reading in the papers and on Twitter and places like that, people are moaning. Everyone's unhappy. People are saying that the new coronavirus rules are very confusing. And while I can see why they would say that, this is nothing for us Jews. Absolutely nothing at all. To me, the rules aren't confusing enough. You know, if this was Jewish law, it would be restaurants and pubs closing at sundown, which would be 6:47 p.m. in Dover, 6:55 in London, and 7:12 in Glasgow. The lucky Scots get an extra 17 minutes drinking time. Of course, that's just for this week. It will change next week. It would be that 6 people can meet in public from Thursday, unless you're Sephardi, in which case it's 8 people from Monday, but that doesn't include anyone under 13 if they're a boy and under 12 if they're a girl. And masks must cover a minimum of a tefach of your face. But of course, even then, there's an argument because Boris Johnson holds that a tefach is actually 3.15 inches, but Nicola Sturgeon says it's 4.2 inches. And of course, it goes without saying that you should have several masks depending on what food you're eating. Being very orthodox, I've actually got 6. Milk, meat and parav, and then the same for Pesach. But one thing I've noticed is that this coronavirus period has made everyone more Jewish. You know, not only is the non-Jewish world having to cope with ever-changing rules and debates among different ministers about how the rules should be interpreted. But they've even started looking at each other in the same way that Jews look at each other. A few years ago, I did a talk called Meshuggah Frum, in which I talked about how every Jewish person thinks that they are perfect, and anyone who does more than them is a complete Meshuggah Frummer, and anyone who does less is basically a Gentile. But this is now what the entire world is doing, not regarding religious observance, but with regarding coronavirus observance. Basically, everyone thinks that their level of COVID observance is perfect, that they're doing the right amount of washing, the right amount of mask wearing, the right amount of social distancing. And anyone who does more than you is a germaphobe, nutcase, Howard Hughes-level lunatic. And anyone who does less than you is an absolute disgrace, that they've got blood on their hands, and that any deaths that happen from now on, they will be personally responsible. Anyway, it's a few days until Yom Kippur and a full day of fasting, so I need to go and get some food now before the restaurants close at 10 p.m. So have a very good Shabbos, fast well, and I will speak to you soon. Bye!
Thank you very much to Ashley Blaker, offering us his unique take on the world as we've come to know it. And that's it for this edition of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life here in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, you can always visit gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to say thank you to all of our guests. That's Vice Chair of Jewish Labour Movement Ruth Smith, Rabbi at St. John's Wood Synagogue Yoni Golka, Ashley Blaker. Of course, thank you also to our paper review team. They were Justin Cohen and Fran Wolfish. And we must also say thank you to Justin for producing this episode of the Jewish News Podcast, as well as Adam Bradley for his work on post-production. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear about any previous episode or be informed when any new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we have featured, you can always visit jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, well, then we'd love to hear from you. You can always email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. Oh, and at this stage, might I say many happy returns to our very own Richard Ferrer, who might be celebrating a special birthday, but shh, I didn't tell you that. From me, Phil Dave, and the whole team here at the Jewish News Podcast, we wish you well over the fast, and we hope that you'll join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.